If you've been with us over the past number of months, you will hopefully have a sense of having come to know the Apostle Paul as a person. We've traveled with him for a number of weeks now. We've observed him as Dr. Luke describes him to us. We first met him way back in Acts chapter 9 as someone who was deeply trained in Jewish Old Testament history, someone who was a passionate follower of the Jewish faith, someone who was violently opposed to the person of Jesus, this story, this idea that Jesus had risen from the dead. Then we were with him as he was on the road and he met the risen Jesus. And we've seen since that experience how his life has turned around and how he has become so fully convinced of the reality of the risen Jesus that it has changed the direction of his life. I wonder what words you would use to describe the Apostle Paul as we have made this journey with him, as we've come to know him, as we've watched him take these journeys and visit churches and convince people about Jesus and argue in the synagogues and endure all kinds of opposition of various sorts. I wonder what words come to your mind as you think about describing Paul as a person. Is there some feedback here? Yeah. Barton's our man. He will fix it. Thank you. We have the privilege today to continue to come alongside of the Apostle Paul as he is nearing Rome. This has been his objective for quite a long period of time. Paul has wanted to go to Rome. He has said this now for a few chapters. This has been his goal. And now we have the privilege to join him on this journey as he is a prisoner on this ship, but still he is one of the people who is on this ship that makes a voyage to Rome from the city of Caesarea, where we have been with him for the last couple of weeks as he's been giving his defense before Agrippa, King Agrippa and Festus. This is one of those stories where there's lots of verses. It's quite amazing, actually, how much time Dr. Luke gives to this story. It's a total of 59 verses between the beginning of Acts 27 to Acts chapter 28 and verse 16. It's just a long story, and it's a story full of details about how this trip takes place. And I would like us to hear the whole of the story, because I think we miss something if we don't hear the whole of the story. And so what we will do is to make use of the visual Bible yet again. We've been doing that over the last little while. If you haven't been here, the visual Bible is a dramatization of the text. It is a reading of the actual text of the NIV version of the Bible, but it's an acting out of the text. I think it helps us to pay attention and to hear the story. So I would like us to do that this morning. But before we do that, I want us to pay attention to two things I'd like you to do as you listen to the story. The first thing I want us to pay attention to is as you listen to the story, I want you to enjoy the story as a story. This is a remarkable journey, and Dr. Luke, as we have seen, is a skillful writer. He writes with a lot of integrity. He writes with accuracy, too. I was reading through the NIV application commentary, Ajith Fernando, in that book points out that there is a fellow by the name of James Smith who wrote a book about a century ago called The Voyage and Shipwreck of the Apostle Paul. And what this man, James Smith, did was to do some research on the details of the story. Is it plausible? Could it have happened this way? Smith was a mariner, a sailor. He was familiar with the Mediterranean Sea, and his research really shows that this story really could have happened as it's described for us here. And so it's really remarkable. Smith makes this comment. He says, "No sailor would have written in a style so little like that of a sailor." So this account is not written by a sailor. It's written by a doctor, Dr. Luke. right? But he also goes on to say, no man, not a sailor, could have written a narrative of a sea voyage so consistent in all its parts unless from actual observation. And so what we realize here is that Dr. Luke, and Dr. Luke uses the we language here, Dr. Luke is alongside of Paul on this journey. And so we receive this as an amazingly accurate story and a compelling story. And so it's my hope that we will truly enter into the story as we hear it today. I hope you feel a little bit of the spray of the water on your face as we hear it. I also want us to ask two questions of the story when we're finished with, after we've heard the story, I want us to ask two questions. I want to ask, what do we learn about God from this story, and how do we respond to that? And secondly, I want to ask the question, what do we learn about the Apostle Paul in this story? What more do we learn about the Apostle Paul in this story, and how should we respond to that? Just before we hear the story, I want to give us a head start on this idea of getting to know Paul a little better, because there's some language in 2 Corinthians chapter 11 which is very similar to this story. And I want us to pay attention to that language, and because what Paul is doing in 2 Corinthians chapter 11 as he's writing this letter to Corinth, we remember from the second journey that we looked at a few weeks ago that he spent quite a long time in the city of Corinth. He's written one letter to Corinth. Now this is the second letter he's writing to the church at Corinth. And as he's writing this letter, he's writing with a great amount of vulnerability. Paul is opening up his heart to these people. This is 2 Corinthians chapter 11, beginning at verse 21. Listen to the language of Paul. Whatever anyone else dares to boast about, I am speaking as a fool, Paul says, I also dare to boast about. Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they Abraham's descendants? So am I. Are they servants of Christ? I am out of my mind to be talking like this. I am more, Paul says. I have worked much harder, been in prison more frequently, been flogged more severely. I've been exposed to death again and again. 5 times I received from the Jews 40 lashes minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. 1 I was pelted with stones. 3 I was shipwrecked. I spent a night and a day in the open sea. I have been constantly on the move. I have been in danger from rivers, in danger from bandits, in danger from my fellow Jews, in danger from Gentiles, in danger in the city, in danger in the country, in danger at sea, in danger from false believers. Do you think Paul's been in danger at all? I have labored and toiled and have often gone without sleep. I have known hunger and thirst and have often gone without food. I have been cold and naked. Beside everything else, I face daily the pressures of my concern for all the churches. Question. What year was this written? If you'd asked me that question yesterday, I wouldn't have known. Here's the answer. This letter was written in approximately AD 55. What year did Paul make this journey to Rome that's described in Acts 27? He makes this about 5 years later, in about AD 60. I don't know if you're like me, but as I've read this chapter of 2 Corinthians before, I've always just assumed that Paul was talking about the event of the shipwreck on the way to Rome. What we discover is actually that Paul wrote this before that. He's been shipwrecked already 3 times before this incident that we're going to see today. I want to suggest we learn 2 things about Paul from this passage before we come to our story. First, we learn is that he is an experienced sailor. Already, he's been on the sea many times. He's been shipwrecked 3 times. N.T. Wright, in his commentary on the book of Acts, reminds us that this is quite unusual for a Jewish person. The Jews, as a whole, were not a seafaring people. We don't read about the Jews taking ships to the ocean like some of their surrounding nations. In fact, if you read through the Old Testament history, the sea is very often, it's the enemy, it's the place of the curse, it's the place where the trouble comes from. And so we think of the story of the flood. We think of the story of Exodus even, and how the sea was a barrier to them that God opened up so that they could find a way through. We think of the story of Jonah. Almost every instance, the sea is an evil place, a place of judgment. And yet, what we find here is that Paul, and what we've observed over the last few weeks, is that Paul is actually one who has been on the sea quite a bit. We've seen him taking these journeys all around the Mediterranean. And here in 2 Corinthians, we read already three times he has been shipwrecked. Why is this important? Well, I want to suggest that you pay attention to this as you observe Paul as this story in Acts 27 and 28 unfolds, because we see him in this story as a man with experience on the sea. This is an experience that God gave to him so that he could act in a particular way on this journey. And we'll pay more attention to that. But what we do learn is that Paul is already an experienced sailor. Second thing I want us to notice from this passage in 2 Corinthians, as Paul is opening his heart to the people at Corinth, is that he endures danger, as he says in this passage in 2 Corinthians, he endured all this danger because of, and the very last line it says, because of his concern for all the churches. Why does Paul put himself in this place of danger? Why does Paul allow these dangers and this opposition to come to him? Paul does not go looking for dangerous situations just because it's fun. Paul is enduring hardship because he cares about people, because he cares about these churches, because he cares what people think about Jesus. He cares whether people know or not that this Jesus really is risen from the dead. He cares so much about this that he is willing to endure this hardship. And so I want us to observe together this yet another hardship for the Apostle Paul, as he, with 275 friends, as they become on the journey, endure this difficult journey together. A couple of practical notes. As the story opens, it's really what I think is supposed to be Dr. Luke, who is retelling this story to his friends. And then the story goes into the actual storyline of the journey. And when it does that, they represent it at nighttime, and they represent it as and it's quite dark. So we won't see all of the details on the screen. It's still quite light in here. But what I want you to do is not be distracted by that, but to pay attention to the words and the sense of the story as it unfolds. So let's enjoy this story together, and then we'll make those observations afterwards.
When it was decided that we would sail for Italy, Paul and some other prisoners were handed over to a centurion named Julius, who belonged to the Imperial Regiment. We boarded a ship from Adramidium about to sail for ports along the coast of the province of Asia, and we put out to sea. Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica, was with us. The next day we landed at Sidon, and Julius, in kindness to Paul, allowed him to go to his friends so they might provide for his needs. From there we put out to sea again and passed to the lee of Cyprus because the winds were against us. When we had sailed across the open sea off the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we landed at Myra and Lycia. There the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy and put us on board. We made slow headway for many days and had difficulty arriving off Cnidus. When the wind did not allow us to hold our course, we sailed to the lee of Crete, opposite Salmone. We moved along the coast with difficulty and came to a place called Fair Havens, near the town of Lacia. Much time had been lost, and sailing had already become dangerous because by now it was after the Day of Atonement. So Paul warned them,
"Men, I can see that our voyage is going to be disastrous and bring great loss to ship and cargo, and to our own lives also."
But the centurion, instead of listening to what Paul said, followed the advice of the pilot and of the owner of the ship. Since the harbor was unsuitable to winter in, the majority decided that we should sail on, hoping to reach Phoenix and winter there. This was a harbor in Crete, facing both southwest and northwest. When a gentle south wind began to blow, they saw their opportunity. So they weighed anchor and sailed along the shore of Crete. Before very long, a wind of hurricane force called the Northeaster swept down from the island. The ship was caught by the storm and could not head into the wind. So we gave way to it and were driven along. As we passed to the lee of a small island called Cauda, we were hardly able to make the lifeboat secure, so the men hoisted it aboard. Then they passed ropes under the ship itself to hold it together. Because they were afraid they would run aground on the sandbars of Syrtis, they lowered the sea anchor and let the ship be driven along. We took such a violent battering from the storm that the next day they began to throw the cargo overboard. On the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days and the storm continued raging, we finally gave up all hope of being saved. After they had gone a long time without food, Paul stood up before them and said,
"Men, you should have taken my advice not to sail from Crete. Then you would have spared yourselves this damage and loss. But now I urge you to keep up your courage, because not one of you will be lost. Only the ship will be destroyed. Last night, an angel of the God whose I am and whom I serve stood beside me and said, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand trial before Caesar, and God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you. So keep up your courage, men, for I have faith in God that it will happen just as he told me. Nevertheless, we must run aground on some island.'"
On the 14th night, we were still being driven across the Adriatic Sea, when about midnight, the sailors sensed they were approaching land. They took soundings and found that the water was 120 feet deep. A short time later, they took soundings again and found it was 90 feet deep. Fearing that we would be dashed against the rocks, they dropped four anchors from the stern and prayed for daylight. In an attempt to escape from the ship, the sailors let the lifeboat down into the sea, pretending they were going to lower some anchors from the bow. Then Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers,
"Unless these men stay with the ship, you cannot be saved."
So the soldiers cut the ropes that held the lifeboat and let it drift away. Just before dawn, Paul urged them all to eat.
"For the last 14 days, you have been in constant suspense and have gone without food. You haven't eaten anything. Now I urge you to take some food. You need it to survive. Not one of you will lose a single hair from his head."
After he said this, he took some bread and gave thanks to God in front of them all. Then he broke it and began to eat. They were all encouraged and ate some food themselves. Altogether, there were 276 of us on board. When they had eaten as much as they wanted, they lightened the ship by throwing the grain into the sea. When daylight came, they did not recognize the land, but they saw a bay with a sandy beach, where they decided to run the ship aground if they could. Cutting loose the anchors, they left them in the sea and at the same time untied the ropes that held the rudders. Then they hoisted the foresail to the wind and made for the beach. But the ship struck a sandbar and ran aground. The bow struck fast and would not move, and the stern was broken to pieces by the pounding of the surf. The soldiers planned to kill the prisoners to prevent any of them from swimming away and escaping. But the centurion wanted to spare Paul's life and kept them from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and get to land. The rest were to get there on planks or on other pieces of the ship. In this way, everyone reached land safely. Once safely on shore, we found out that the island was called Malta. The islanders showed us unusual kindness. They built a fire and welcomed us all because it was raining and cold. Paul gathered a pile of brushwood and, as he put it on the fire, a viper, driven out by the heat, fastened itself on his hand. When the islanders saw the snake hanging from his hand, they said to each other,
"This man must be a murderer. For though he escaped from the sea, the goddess Justice has not allowed him to live."
But Paul shook the snake off into the fire and suffered no ill effects. The people expected him to swell up or suddenly fall dead. But after waiting a long time and seeing nothing unusual happen to him, they changed their minds and said he was a god. There was an estate nearby that belonged to Publius, the chief official of the island. He welcomed us to his home and showed us generous hospitality for 3 days. His father was sick in bed, suffering from fever and dysentery. Paul went in to see him and, after prayer, placed his hands on him and healed him. When this had happened, the rest of the sick on the island came and were cured. They honored us in many ways, and when we were ready to sail, they furnished us with the supplies we needed. After 3 months, we put out to sea in a ship that had wintered in the island. It was an Alexandrian ship with the figurehead of the twin gods Castor and Pollux. We put in at Syracuse and stayed there 3 days. From there, we set sail and arrived at Rhegium. The next day, the south wind came up, and on the following day, we reached Puteoli. There, we found some believers who invited us to spend a week with them, and so we came to Rome. The believers there had heard that we were coming, and they traveled as far as the Forum of Appius and the Three Taverns to meet us. At the sight of these people, Paul thanked God and was encouraged. When we got to Rome, Paul was allowed to live by himself, with a soldier to guard him.
A story with amazing detail, which we don't have time to really look at with any amount of detail. So what I would like to do is just put a map on the screen to just get you a sense of where the journey happened. We're not going to take time to look at it in detail, but Caesarea is down there. That's where Paul was before Festus and before King Agrippa, and the red line there is roughly the journey as it unfolded as we heard it before us. What I do want us to do is ask a couple of questions about this story, as I mentioned before. And the first question really is, what do we learn about God from the way this story unfolds, and how should we respond to that? I want to suggest two words which really struck me, actually, as I was contemplating this story, and looking at the story from a perspective of saying, what can we learn about God from this story? We learn, I believe, that God is sovereign. That means that God is in control. God is in charge. God is all-powerful. But we also learn from this story that God is involved in the lives of his people. In verse 23, it's a remarkable statement. As you remember, Paul was standing there and everybody's afraid for their lives. And Paul says this to them in verse 23, "Last night, an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve stood beside me. And he said, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand on trial before Caesar, and God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you.'" So here's a picture of God who is sovereign, who is able to save people from certain death in the storm, a God who has control of the storm itself. And yet, he is not a God who is sovereign and in control, but distant. He's a God who comes and stands near to Paul, which we've seen before in Paul's journey, right? But once again, Paul, he comes near to Paul. He sends an angel, at least, to come near to Paul. And he speaks to Paul, and he says, "You will reach Rome, and all of those who are with you, I'm giving you the gracious gift of life." It's an amazing intervention by a sovereign God. There's something beautiful and something comforting as we see these two words together, as we look at God's involvement in this story. Sometimes, perhaps, we believe in a God who is all-powerful, a God who is the creator of all things, a God who is able to do anything that he wants, but perhaps we think of him as distant and not involved. Other times, perhaps, we think about God as a God who is involved in our lives, but maybe we're not quite sure if he really has the power to fix what's wrong right now. I really do see this story as a story which helps us to see a God who is sovereign, and yet a God who is also deeply concerned, and not only deeply concerned, but deeply involved in the lives of his people. And so how do we respond to this reality of God who is both sovereign and involved. Well, we must certainly give thanks to this God, yeah? We must give thanks to this God who is in control of all things, and yet a God who is actively involved in our lives day by day. And then we take this God from that story and we bring him into our own stories. And it may be that we are involved in a crisis of some sort in our lives. Or it may be that we have been involved in a crisis in the past. And it is probably likely that we will be involved in a crisis sometime in the future. And we look at this God as a God who is sovereign, and above all, he is able to do anything because he is the God of all creation. Nothing has been made that was not made by him. And so he is sovereign and in control. And yet he is also a God who is near. He is a God who is close. He is a God who cares and gets involved in the crises of our lives. And so we may take great comfort from this today, that God is not only a God who is sovereign and in control, but he is a God who is involved in our lives. So it's my prayer as we observe this God from this story, that we would also observe this God in our lives. That whatever's going on in our lives, we would see him as the sovereign God who's in control when everything seems out of control. But also a God who is deeply caring and deeply loving and deeply involved in those details of our lives. Secondly, I want us to ask the question, what do we learn about Paul from this story? What do we learn about Paul? What do we learn about Paul and how he acts and reacts in this story? And what can we learn? How do we respond to this from ourselves? Without going into a lot of detail, I want to suggest that my overall impression of Paul in this story is what we see him emerging in this group of 276 people. We see him emerging as a leader, but also as a servant. I want to suggest four ways in which we see this happen. Once again, we don't have time to go into all of the details, but let me outline these four ways in which I see Paul being a servant leader on this voyage. We see, first of all, that he uses his skills and experience to add wisdom and advice. Do you remember we noticed before that already Paul has been shipwrecked three times? He knows about the ocean. He knows about the Mediterranean Sea. He knows about sailing on the Mediterranean Sea. And so we remember that when they were getting ready to sail, Paul said, you know, it's getting into October now, because that's the season it was coming to be. It's getting into the season of storms. I don't think we should sail. Paul is giving that advice. Where's that coming from? It's coming from the experience, the skills that God has given him in the past, right? Because he's already had that experience. And so he is able, based on the experiences that God has given him, to offer that wisdom, to offer that sense of, you know, probably we shouldn't do this. Of course, they didn't listen to him. A second way in which I see Paul being a servant leader here is that he is, even in the midst of the crisis, hearing the voice of God. He's paying attention to what God is saying to him. He's saying, last night God said to me through his angel. And I believe what we see Paul doing, even in the midst of this crisis, is having his ears open to what God wants to say to him. Thirdly, I want to suggest what we see Paul doing so effectively in this story is we see him caring for the basic needs of others. You remember when he said to them, you know, it's 14 days you haven't been eating. It's time we need to eat something, folks. We need to break some bread together. It's a beautiful scene of Paul breaking bread and sharing it with the other folks on the boat and giving them physical strength because they needed it. Paul cares about these physical needs of the people that he's with. A fourth way that I suggest we see him being a servant leader is his praying for the sick. Paul prays for Publius's father and for others who were brought to him on the island. And so Paul is involved again as a servant of Jesus who believes in the healing power of Jesus in praying for those who are sick, who are close to him. So many other ways which we could look at, so many other details, but let me ask the question, how do we respond to observing Paul in this way? I want to suggest as we look at these four ways in which Paul acts as a servant leader, that these may be replicated in our lives. These are not distant objectives. These are things that we who are followers of Jesus may also put our minds to. So God has given to each one of us experiences, the experiences, the crises, the different experiences of life that we've had that have formed and shaped us as to who we are. God has given us those as a gift. And I believe that in whatever circumstance of life we might be, wherever we work, whoever we work with, whoever we live next to as neighbors, whatever our family situation, God has given those things to us as a gift so that we may use the wisdom that we have learned to bless others, to speak into situations that people are facing day by day, so that we can share wisdom together. And God calls us to do that. God has given us this gift of experience and wisdom. And so we learn to share that together as we live close to one another, as we work with one another. We also do have the opportunity to hear God's voice. If we're followers of Jesus, Jesus longs to speak to us. The question is, do we take time to listen? It's so easy to get caught up in the busyness of life, to get caught up in doing things for Jesus, get caught up in doing so many things in life, that maybe what we need to do is to stop and to listen for the voice of Jesus in our lives. What is God saying to us as we take time to be quiet, as we take time to reflect on His Word, as we take time to open our ears to hear what God would want to say to us? God still loves to speak to His people. We also can be involved in caring for the basic needs of others. Of course, we can look at so many people in Scripture to find examples of this, at Jesus Himself, as He cares for the needs of people. And so we too, as servant leaders, as people who are living in this world as servants of Jesus, we are called to serve others. We're called to serve the needs of those who are close to us. And we also have the opportunity to pray for those who are sick, and to pray for those people in the name of Jesus. And so what do we learn from observing Paul as a servant leader in this story? I believe that we can learn that the way in which Paul acts here is real. This is real Paul living in a real crisis, reaching out to the friends who are with him on that ship. And I believe that we can learn in our own lives to reflect upon the situation that God has put us in here as we live in Kyrgyzstan. Who is it that God is calling us to reach out to? Who is it that God is calling us to give this practical sort of aid to? Who is it that God is calling us to pray for? What are those experiences that I have had that equip me now to reach out and to bless the people who are around me? And so we learn and we take courage and we challenge ourselves to more and more day by day to be servant leaders in the context in which we live and work here in this country. Well, Paul arrives in Rome. The journey that he has been looking forward to for so long is now complete. He's in Rome. Next week, we will notice his emphasis of his time while he's in Rome, as it's recorded in the last part of chapter 28. We do have the privilege next week, too, of celebrating baptisms. And so it's a great coming together of events as we look at this culmination of this journey of the gospel from Jerusalem to Rome. It's arriving in Rome, and Paul is still the ambassador of it there. And then to look at the gospel lived out in the act of baptism next week. And so we really do look forward to what God is going to do in our midst next Sunday. Meanwhile, let us learn to pay attention to God, who is sovereign and yet involved in our lives. And let us take from Paul a lesson to be a servant leader who is using the gifts and skills that God has given us, a servant leader who is hearing the voice of God in our lives, a servant leader who is caring for the needs of those who are around us, and a servant leader who is ready to pray for those who are close to us. Let us pray together.